Every Democrat must feel honor-bound to control the vote of at least one Negro by intimidation, purchase, keeping him away from the polls, or, as each individual may determine, how he may best accomplish it. Never threaten a man individually if he deserves to be threatened, for the necessities of the time require that he should die. A dead radical is very harmless. A threatened radical, or one driven off by threats from the scene of his operations, is often very troublesome, sometimes dangerous, always vindictive. The primer of a reactionary South Carolina faction called the Red Shirts shows how volatile conditions were in this country during the decade after the Civil War. Even though secession and slavery had been done away with by military conquest, the reunification of North and South was by no means a given. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Who had the political power in the South during Reconstruction, and what were their aims? How free were the freed slaves? What part did the development of the West play in reuniting the country? And at what point was it safe to say that the country was put back together? Joining us again is Steve Kantrowitz, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome back to University of the Year.
Glad to be here.
It must have been incredible for those living during this time to adjust to the end of slavery suddenly. Put us back in 1865 and give us some sense of what that was like.
Yeah. The end of slavery is such a social and political and economic earthquake that people at the time struggle for metaphors. They think in terms of end times sometimes, if they're versed in the Bible. Gabriel, blow your horn. There are all kinds of invocations of truly world-turning events. The most common one among former slaves is bottom rails on top now. If the antebellum South and the Civil War South had been a fence rail society in which some people were on the top and some on the middle and some on the bottom, then it was possible to imagine that the end of slavery would simply invert that hierarchy. And the question was, in many people's minds, what would such an inversion mean? Or were we in fact thinking about an inversion or a leveling, an equalization of statuses? Those questions were very much up in the air from the end of slavery and especially from the defeat of the Confederacy forward, and they remained so for more than a decade.
Well, let's look at some of the struggles for not just Reconstruction but reorganization, I guess you would say. First, at the family level, it's easy to overlook how catastrophic that war and slavery, for that matter, before it had been for family structure.
Absolutely. Slavery by its nature forbids slaves to have legally binding and enforceable relationships with one another. It restricts such relationships to masters and slaves. So slaves do not have the right to marry. They don't have the right to raise their children. There's no right to have any formal relationship with another member of one's family. Despite that, of course, slaves create all kinds of what we would recognize in some sense as nuclear families and also greatly extended networks of real and fictive kin, people called cousins or uncles or aunts who are not literally blood relations but are treated as such because they're brought together on a plantation or in a community over time. What's really astonishing about the world after slavery is how determinedly many former slaves set about trying to reconstruct relationships that had been disrupted by the interstate slave trade more than a decade before, sometimes two decades before. You find in the newspapers that emerged to serve the recently freed black communities of the South in 1865, find newspaper classified ads of people seeking one another, often seeking family members who had been separated from them years and years before.
There's one remarkable one that you have brought in, actually, remarkable in a couple of ways. It mentions a $200 reward and then goes on to say that the people being sought were last seen in 1849.
This is from a newspaper called The Colored Tennessean, and this the issue of August 12th, 1865. $200 reward. During the year 1849, Thomas Sample carried away from this city, as his slaves, our daughter Polly and son George Washington, to the state of Mississippi and subsequently to Texas. And when last heard from, they were in LaGrange, Texas. We will give $100 each for them to any person who will assist them, or either of them, to get to Nashville or get word to us of their whereabouts, if they are alive. Ben and Flora East.
And that's from Tennessee to Texas already, a divide of considerable geography and time, 16 years.
Think about what's implicit in this text. Not only over 16 years have these parents continued to wonder about the fate of their children, but they know that they were taken from Tennessee to Mississippi and from there to Texas, and they know the name of a town in Texas. Now, keep in mind that these were probably illiterate people. The great majority of slaves were, so presumably they dictated this ad. Perhaps they were literate. But in any case, they have somehow accumulated information about people who at some point in the last 16 years lived, you know, 800-900 miles away perhaps, and have continued to feel deeply connected to them over that time, and now see emancipation as an opportunity to reconstitute, to reconstruct family bonds that have been destroyed by slavery.
It's so poignant to hear that.
If they are alive.
Yeah.
Because they don't know. That's the thing about this, is that it's so hard to tell. Not only perhaps they had known of their you know, their whether they were alive or not as recently as 1859 or 60, but did they survive the Civil War? You know, what, that's a whole other question.
Right, or any number of other vicissitudes of the times.
We're thinking about millions now of people, right?
About 4 million people, a little under 4 million.
Well, how mobile were all these 4 million? I mean, obviously we know about those who had managed to get north, a very small minority, mm-hmm. through the Underground Railroad or one mm-hmm. or another means like that. But when suddenly they are at least in principle free to travel about the country, what happens?
Well, several things happen. What's so striking and so troublesome about Reconstruction is that for former slaves, the freedom from constraint, the freedom from imprisonment essentially in the sort of slave camps of the antebellum South means the ability to decide where they're going to live, among whom they're going to live, whether they're going to put their effort into seeking a particular kind of employment or in seeking to find family members or something else. To former slaveholders, that looks like, set free from slavery, the Negro does nothing but wander. He will not work. We get this kind of rhetoric instantly because former slaveholders simply can't imagine a world in which their former slaves are not somehow held to labor, perhaps not literally by legal slavery, but by some form of economic or political coercion or some combination of those that will keep those millions of black Southerners on the land as the sort of agricultural labor force that they have been for generations. And so between those two expectations, the one of being able to determine on our own as individuals and as a community what we will do with freedom and these black people have to be made to work, that is a divide of expectations and understandings that's really too wide for any set of policies to bridge.
Well, and presumably the freed slaves had no money.
That's right.
And what were they supposed to do at that point? I mean, can you walk us through what it would have been like in a typical household on a plantation
right.
where slavery is over and then what?
Right. The slaveholders had invested themselves by and large in the Confederacy and in the Confederate war effort. And at the end of the war, whatever, you know, Confederate currency they had, as grossly devalued as it had been by inflation, is now literally worthless. The slaves who had been in many cases the bulk of their capital investment are erased as wealth. The only thing that the former slaveholders have left that is worth anything is the land and the potential for a saleable crop that could come off that land. The former slaves have very little money, although interestingly some had managed to accumulate it and continue to manage to accumulate it despite the fact that slaves are not supposed to own other property.
Yeah, well, this ad, $200 reward,
right.
That's a lot of money.
That's very striking. That's August of 1865, you know. Now, granted, Tennessee, these people could have been free for several years at that point, conceivably, depending on where in Tennessee they had been. But nonetheless, it's slaves are beginning to accumulate capital, but they're, you know, their reserves are very small. Freed people are approaching the postbellum years with almost nothing but their labor to sell. And so the former slaveholders are not exactly wrong to imagine that they're going to be able to coerce many of these people into some kind of economic arrangement that at least in some sense suits them, that enables the former slaveholders to turn their land's potential for wealth into real wealth by
sharecropping.
Well, sharecropping emerges out of the struggle that begins here. You know, if one group has land but no labor and one has labor but no land, you can easily see how some kind of arrangement can be made. The problem is, what's the basis for that arrangement? Slaves have something like a labor theory of value. They believe that they have been defrauded of the worth of their labor by their former owners, and they want as much of it as they can have. Former slaveholders have a very hard time imagining that slaves are entitled to anything but subsistence. So there's, again, a huge gap there. What you find is the very first contracts that former slaveholders and former slaves sign, former slaveholders are offering, for example, a 1/12 of the corn, a 1/10 of the peas, an 1/8 of the this and that, right? Tiny fractions of what the former slaves are producing. The very next year, the contracts get a whole lot better. And that is, one, because former slaves learn how to bargain and learn how to assert themselves in the contracting process more effectively over time, and they more and more effectively over time. And second, they have more allies. The federal government has begun sending agents of the new Freedmen's Bureau south, and some of those agents are stepping in, at least to some extent, on the side of the freed people and saying, that's not a fair contract. Here's what a reasonable contract might look like.
Is there part of a problem, though, when we're talking the South in 1865, 1866 or so? Where's the cash money?
Right. Huge problem. Nobody has money to invest. You do get, in some places, northern capitalists, entrepreneurs, philanthropists too, moving south and trying to invest themselves, sometimes for good, sometimes for money, in the process of rethinking southern agriculture. But the real problem is, if former slaveholders had had their druthers, they would simply pay a cash wage every day. But they can't. They don't have any cash. Next best would probably be to bind people to annual contracts that they could literally enforce, that they could physically hold people to labor. But the 13th Amendment, the end of slavery, makes that impossible. So they go looking for forms of contract that are coercive enough to keep people working for them and for forms of enforcement that will give those laws some teeth.
Well, you do have something like the company store coming mm-hmm. to the fore here, where it, in effect it can be a very close thing to slavery.
Sure. And we will get there, right? In many ways, the sharecropping world that evolves by the 1880s and 90s has many features in common with other kinds of very coercive and abusive labor relations, like the kinds that lead to a company store and scrip and all kinds of non-cash transactions. But here, in this very fluid moment after the war, freed people are not willing to consent to an arrangement as restrictive as that and vote with their feet. Huge mobility from places where people had been slaves to other places. Now, if you look back from 1880, on some plantations, you might find as many as half the people had been slaves on the plantation in 1860, but half had not. And half the people who'd been there in 1860 are no longer there. So you get people deciding they'll stick with the neighborhood they know, they'll stick with the community people they know, even though some will leave, and others saying, we're going.
North?
And going some
out of
going
the old
north,
Confederacy?
Some going north, more going west, more going to places where it's possible to imagine that they could find growing land where they could put to use the skills they had. Arkansas, for example.
You mentioned that many couldn't read because it had been in a lot of states against the law to teach a slave to read
Absolutely.
Or write. I'm thinking, you know, if they're trying to negotiate about percentages, trying to figure out geographically where to go to read the various documents they'd need to have that sort of freedom, what kind of efforts were made initially to get education into slaves' lives?
Well, free people earnestly seek literacy and other forms of education, but literacy really first and foremost. You find this even before the end of the war. You find people in contraband camps and other places where freed people begin assembling. Teachers are among the most prized individuals in the place. And there are many northern groups that start sending missionaries who find that most of what they're ending up doing is teaching people to read and teaching some basic skills and lessons in what free life looks like. And that might mean showing them a globe and talking about the geography of the world. It might also mean educating people in the importance of contract, how central contractual relations would be, and the theory of contract, in fact, would be to their lives as free people. Because the world of slavery is a world of deference and reciprocity and obligation. It's a world of hierarchies in which people are supposed to have both responsibilities and duties and obligations to one another. Now, in reality, of course, slaves have very little power to enforce any of that. But there's a tradition, for example, that on Christmas Day, masters and slaves give gifts to one another. And slaves' gifts to masters might be very small things, and slave masters' gifts to slaves might be small as well. But there's a tradition of at least bowing to the idea that there is a relationship of mutual obligation there. Strikingly, after the end of slavery, you still find on Christmas Day former slaves going to the houses of their former masters, presenting small gifts and expecting gifts in return. So generations of experience of a slave system don't simply disappear. Just because the formal institution's been abolished doesn't mean that people don't think, well, something's in this system actually had a benefit. If we present a small trinket to the people who used to be our masters, we might get a gift of some consequence in return. Former masters are heartened by this but are mistaken if they think that it means that former slaves are going to actually continue to honor former slaveholders' vision of what slavery was. They're not. So that leads to a lot of hard feeling. You find former slaveholders saying to their slaves, you keep saying that you want your wife. She's not your wife. I gave her to you during good behavior, and you haven't behaved well. You know, this in 1865.
Expecting those former relationships to carry through despite the constitutional amendment.
Exactly. It's a very hard thing for people to get their heads around that this is over.
Let's find out what some of those state legislatures looked like in the South during Reconstruction when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Wisconsin Public Radio now offers three networks, NPR News and Classical Music, Ideas, and our new Classical HD network. When you have questions about them, call our audience services team at 800-747-7444.
All freedmen, free Negroes and mulattoes in this state over the age of 18 years, found on the second Monday in January 1866 or thereafter with no lawful employment or business, or found unlawful assembling themselves together, shall be deemed vagrants, and on conviction thereof shall be fined in a sum not exceeding, in the case of a freedman, free Negro or mulatto, $50, and imprisonment at the discretion of the court not exceeding 10 days. If any freedman, free Negro, or mulatto shall fail or refuse to pay any tax levied according to the provisions of the sixth section of this act, it shall be prima facie evidence of vagrancy, and it shall be the duty of the sheriff to arrest such freedman, free Negro, or mulatto, or such person refusing or neglecting to pay such tax, and proceed at once to hire for the shortest time such delinquent taxpayer to anyone who will pay the said tax, with accruing costs, giving preference to the employer, if there be one. Two sections of a law from the state of Mississippi, the Act to Amend the Vagrant Laws of the State of 1865. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Steve Kantrowitz, and we're looking at Reconstruction, the United States undergoing a shaky reunification after the Civil War. Well, Steve, it's one thing to have all these great ideas about how freed slaves should have rights and the ability to make a living and all that in the South and have great relationships with their former masters, but it does all have to be done through state legislatures ultimately, doesn't it, constitutionally?
It does, and it matters very much who gets to elect those state legislatures, and and then what those state legislatures do. The law that you read from Mississippi in 1865 was produced by a legislature elected by the 1860 electorate of Mississippi,
so,
which means the same people who took totally Mississippi out of the Union in 1860, a
legislature.
Confederate legislature essentially, a white man's legislature. And of course, such a legislature very much speaks to the needs of landowners, former slaveholders. And from their perspective, the vagrancy laws of the state, which had once of course only applied to free white people, now apply to the vast majority of Mississippi's population, 2/3 or so of its population, which is black. And so the vagrancy laws are very specifically racially targeted here and are intended to force freed people to work on the land, to show evidence of employment and to pay taxes in cash that are based in some form of employment. And if they can't, then guess what? They get bound out to labor. It's laws like these that cause the Republicans in Congress, the Republican majority in Congress, to sit up and take notice and say, this is not quite what we had in mind when we started to readmit states to the Union during the Civil War. And perhaps reunification or readmission of the seceded states that proceeds on this basis is not actually in keeping with the spirit of Union victory.
And at this point, it's legal for a state to pass laws such as this? There's no control over
– the control of this at this point is at least by default in the hands of the president, which at this point is Andrew Johnson.
Whoops.
Yeah.
From Tennessee.
A man who had made his political mark both in some small regard at least by attacking slaveholders and by being the only representative of a seceded state in the Senate to remain in the Senate after secession. So he gets enormous respect from Unionists in the North for being the representative of the loyal South. But his loyalty does not extend to the former slaves. Andrew Johnson believes that the United States is a white republic. He does not believe that it should be a colorblind nation. He very much rejects that part of Lincoln's evolving legacy in 1865. And it becomes clearer and clearer first to abolitionists and to free blacks and to freed people and then to Republicans in Congress in general that Andrew Johnson is really not their ally.
So are these laws somehow to end up before the Supreme Court and declared unconstitutional?
No. Congress steps in. Congress decides that Andrew Johnson is not going to be able to call the shots on Reconstruction policy if he's going to allow states to return to the Union on this basis. And when the states like Mississippi elect representatives to Congress to come and sit in Congress in 1866, Congress says no. The Republican clerk of the House simply does not read the names of those representatives. They are not seated in that Congress. And Congress sets about reversing Johnson's Reconstruction policy. They pass a Civil Rights Act in 1866 that basically overturns this. It makes it illegal to pass laws that do not create racial equality in the protection of the laws. Johnson vetoes the Civil Rights Act of 1866. Congress passes it over his veto.
And isn't that the first time that there's
First time
there's an overridden veto?
Yep. And then they do it again because Johnson vetoes the renewal of the Freedmen's Bureau and they override that veto. And then in very short order, they take control of Reconstruction from Johnson by establishing what are called the Reconstruction Acts beginning in March of 1867, which say these state governments are void. Whatever they did in 1865 and 1866, we are going to reoccupy the South formally. We're going to create 5 military districts across 10 of the 11 former Confederate states, and we are going to hold registration for new elections. And the basis of those elections is going to be manhood suffrage.
So universal male suffrage.
Yeah. The basis for those elections. That's mm-hmm. They're not stipulating that that has to be the outcome yet of any constitutions produced in those elections. Still, that's where it's headed.
It must be. You know, we talk about polarized politics or partisanship now, but it must have been incredibly divisive at this point just to go into Congress or any of the discourse about what to do with the country so split apart.
Yeah, it's not as perhaps as polarized as it had been in 1860 or 61. In 1860 or 61, people were packing pistols and knives on the floor of Congress.
Secession was not an issue. Slavery was not an issue.
And furthermore, half of the people who would create the two poles here are actually excluded from Congress for a while here. some of them formally barred from holding federal office by having been high Confederate officers or having betrayed an oath to the Union and then served in the Confederate military. But politics, yes, politics broadly are as polarized as they had ever been, because when one part of the electorate does not recognize that another part of the electorate belongs in the electorate, then you have the, you know, the recipe for the most intense polarization.
So for this series of elections, we have universal male suffrage, black and white. What kind of state legislatures come out of it?
Well, state legislatures, they're all over the map. In some places, for example, Virginia, very modest changes. Very few black elected officials, a very slow motion, very conservative reconstruction process that pretty much ends even before it gets going. There are almost no radical shifts right away in Virginia. On the other hand, in states where there was a black majority, such as Mississippi or South Carolina, or near majorities in Alabama or Georgia, you get very dramatic shifts, at least at the outset, and in some cases for much longer than that. You get the election of large numbers of black men, some of whom had been slaves fairly recently, to the state legislature, to the state senate, and in some cases to high state office, the office of Secretary of State, Lieutenant Governor. Eventually, we get governors and U.S. senators, which of course were then elected by the state legislatures. We get black political power to a degree and in numbers that had never been seen before in the United States.
And you start seeing efforts to bar black men from the polls right away?
Initially, in 1865 and 1866, yes, these governments exist to prevent that from happening. Congress moves to make it happen, and then there's a very intense mobilization of the potential black male electorate of the South through the Union Leagues, which kind of operate as Southern arms of the Republican Party, and which pretty quickly organize into local Republican clubs. The Republican Party becomes the party of former slaves and recruits some white Southerners into its ranks, some places more than others. Western North Carolina, a lot of white Republicans. Lowcountry South Carolina, not so many. Depends on how invested people had been in the plantation complex and how invested they are in maintaining local white supremacy over a black majority.
Well, we remember, for example, that Virginia split in two to the extent of West Virginia breaking off and becoming a unionist state.
That's right. That's right. And it remains so after the war. The critical development following those elections under the Reconstruction Acts in 1867 is first the creation of new state legislatures and then their process of lawmaking. They begin writing constitutions for the southern states that are very different than the ones written in 1865 and 66. These constitutions are written by state legislatures made up of black and white men, including many former slaves and including free black northerners and white northerners who have come south for the purpose of taking part in Reconstruction. These are the so-called carpetbaggers. What happens in pretty short order is you get some of the most, by the standards of the day, some of the most progressive constitutions in the United States are in southern states. They have provisions looking forward toward universal public education, sometimes toward married women's property legislation. They imagine a colorblind liberal polity, not liberal in the sort of late 20th century United States sense, but liberal in the sense of individual liberty and kind of individual right of contract. And it's a revolution in Southern history and in Southern life. It's also a revolution in American constitutional history and life because one of the stipulations that Congress sets for readmission to the Union for these states now writing these new constitutions is that they ratify the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment is basically the Civil Rights Act of 1866 that Johnson had vetoed and Congress had passed over his veto, now written as a constitutional amendment, out of the power of any future Congress or president to undo, absent another constitutional amendment. And the 14th Amendment creates a new principle, and that is a universal national citizenship. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. So no state can establish a second class of citizenship anymore, as had been so common, not just in the South where most black people had been slaves, but in the North where from across most northern states, most free black northerners had also been second-class citizens of some kind or other.
How effective were the various backlashes? Well, we heard from one at the beginning of this conversation about striking back with physical intimidation. How effective was all that, the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, the red shirts?
The violent backlash against Reconstruction begins at the beginning. That is, it begins when the first slave tries to leave the plantation during the Civil War and is beaten or killed or disciplined in some other way by a slaveholder who's angry about it. That's a tradition that does not stop. The terms of that conflict change, though, because freed people can recruit new allies to their side. They have laws on their side. They have sometimes state governments on their side. Sometimes more important, they sometimes have local governments, county governments, sheriffs and sheriff's deputies on their side. That's justices of the peace who will hear their side of the story. They have the Freedmen's Bureau sometimes on their side and its agents, many of whom are union officers who are willing to hear their cases, hear their complaints against people who've done them wrong. So it doesn't have to turn into simply a low-grade war between former slaves and former slaveholders. And they have the resources of their free community to draw on. And you get black self-defense forces in many places. In Wilmington, North Carolina, for example, you get a kind of anti-Ku Klux Klan rising led by a former slave named Abraham Galloway who walks through town with pistols on his hip. You find both a white backlash against black freedom and a black counter-mobilization that in some cases can successfully resist it. The tide of that backlash and the resistance to it ebbs and flows, and it follows to a great degree the overall balance of political power locally in the state and in the nation. So when Democrats and conservatives and white supremacists feel emboldened, the Klan goes on the march. When the federal government or a state government or a local anti-Klan force pushes back, that backlash is suppressed, sometimes quite dramatically suppressed. The Ku Klux Klan, which emerges in 65 and 66, is forcibly and very effectively suppressed by the federal government with an occupation of South Carolina in the early 1870s. It sends the Klan scurrying for cover. And the election of 1872, as the great historian Eric Foner points out, is comparatively peaceful after many years of electoral violence and other conflict between the Klan and the freed people. But a little later, as the federal will to enforce the law wanes, then very quickly you'll find an upsurge in Klan violence again.
What about not sort of overt acts of violence but the sort of trickier methods? I guess what I was getting at with the elections were the literacy tests for voting or just various obstacles that would be put in the way of black men wanting to exercise the right to vote.
Well, the really extraordinary thing about Reconstruction is that those obstacles just can't work at this point. The main obstacle to black men's voting in Reconstruction tends to be physical force. The laws that we're accustomed to thinking of as the basis for disfranchisement, poll taxes, literacy tests, all kinds of kind of arcane legal strategies, those are end runs around the 15th Amendment, around the principle of non-discrimination in voting, at least for men, that's ratified in 1870. But what's required for those laws to be passed at the state level is that black power has been erased at the state level. And so it's really not until after the fall of the Republican governments of Reconstruction that state legislatures and then later state constitutional conventions can get together and say, we're going to prevent that from happening again. And then we get poll taxes and literacy tests and other kinds of laws that without naming we're going after former slaves and their children effectively try to find proxies for race to disfranchise black men. But during Reconstruction, it's a war more than anything else. It's a political fight that takes place at the ballot box, and a ballot box that in the 19th century, not just in the South but everywhere else, includes a lot more violence than we're accustomed to. The polls are a pretty rough place in the 19th century and especially in the Reconstruction South.
We've talked about Andrew Johnson being his vetoes were overridden and so on. What happens as Congress and Andrew Johnson get increasingly at odds?
Yeah, the details are quite complex. But in brief, Johnson sufficiently antagonizes Congress, the Republicans in Congress, that they set about trying to throw him out of office. Johnson's strategy is to forge a new kind of coalition. He wants to reconstitute the wartime Union coalition with a lot more Democrats in it. He wants to be the president of conservative Republicans and Democrats. And he sets about in 1866 and 67 trying to create a kind of a, a new National Union Party that will move away from the radicals in the Republican Party and create a new kind of centrist, white supremacist order for the post-war. Now, he fails to do that. He fails to impede Southern Reconstruction. And in fact, Congress impeaches him for impeding Southern Reconstruction, for violating various laws that they pass in some ways in order to prevent Johnson from doing what he's trying to do, removing officials who are pursuing Reconstruction policies on the ground. They fail to remove Johnson from office. They do essentially eliminate Johnson as a character in national life by 1868. He's not even really an effective candidate for president by then. And the presidency goes very easily to Ulysses S. Grant, to the victorious general of the Union armies, who's the logical Republican candidate in that year and the clear face of enforcement of the laws in the South. So it seems in 1868 and in 1869, as Grant is inaugurated, that Johnson's strategy has been a complete failure. But not quite.
We'll find out how Reconstruction was overthrown when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
When you listen to Wisconsin Public Radio, you're likely to hear an idea that makes a connection to something you've been thinking about. If you need more information, visit our website, wpr.org. There you'll find lots of ways to learn more. wpr.org.
The only question is whether children shall become educated and enlightened or remain in ignorance. The question is not white or black, united or divided, but whether children shall be sent to school or kept at home. If they are compelled to be educated, the masses will be intelligent and will become the great strength and bulwark of republicanism. If they remain uneducated, they will inevitably remain ignorant, and ignorance is the parent of vice and crime and was the sustainer of the late gigantic slaveholders' rebellion. That's Robert Brown Elliott writing in the South Carolina Constitutional Convention of 1868. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Steve Kantrowitz, and we're talking about Reconstruction. Tell us about that statement just now by Elliott on educating children.
Yeah. It seems like a very commonplace thing to assert, right? Universal public education is good because without education, people, you know, can't do as well. Ignorance leads to vice and crime. Very kind of boilerplate 20th century political speech in some ways. But you have to understand just how radical an utterance this is in South Carolina in 1868. Robert Brown Elliott, a black northerner who has come to South Carolina, has been elected to the State Constitutional Convention of 1868 by an electorate composed majority of the electorate is black men in 1868, is saying the state shall compel people to send their children to school. South Carolina had never said that before. And furthermore, where his opponents are going to say, are you going to put black and white children in the same classroom? He says, that's not the issue. The issue is whether or not the state shall compel people to be educated. If it does not, they will fall into ignorance and vice and crime, for example, secession, a great dig at the former slaveholders sitting across from him. The question is, shall the state have an interest in this or not? And the idea that the state has an interest in the common good and that common good is universal, that is really radical. It's hard for us to get our heads around how radical an articulation that is at that moment, both in the sense that state power is presumed to be the agency by which this will happen, and that it applies to black and white children universally. Again, both of these things are things that almost no white South Carolinian in 1862 or 1860 could have imagined would be the result of the Civil War, could never have imagined they would end up in a world where this would happen. And to them, it might look as though the bottom rail was on top now, when in fact, Elliott is very clear what he's calling for is a kind of universality, a universalizing of the principle that all people are created equal and are endowed with certain inalienable rights, and maybe a public education is one of those.
Well, you know, there is a problem implicit here, though, and that is that equality is expensive.
Indeed it is.
And you're talking again about a place that's flat on its back.
Indeed. Well, the difficulty here is how do you fund a system of public education? Now, keep in mind that when they say universal public education, they're talking about probably a 3-month school year and very low-paid teachers, very rudimentary school buildings and that sort of thing, almost no equipment, almost no books, right? So very, very cheap by our standards. Still, all kinds of state expenditure have to be calculated against the impoverishment of the region, just how cash poor they are after Reconstruction. Taxation is the basis of state revenue here, and taxation and the accumulation of bonded debt. Now, the bonded debt is mostly going into the construction of railroads, which becomes a kind of fiasco of corruption and incompetence. And this is not to single out the South. This is a national story of Reconstruction and thereafter.
Wonderful place for corruption to thrive as any kind of railroad.
I used to say the railroads were kind of the Enron of the 1870s. Now I could just say they're the American economy of the, the 1870s, but the Citibank perhaps.
But at least ostensibly a railroad had something tangible that would bring a return on the investment.
Yes. Education, you could make the same argument for education though, as Eliot is in fact making
here. Oh, for sure. But I mean in terms of your everyday taxpayer, I would think no clear, tangible advantage to educating people who had never been educated before. I mean, this is a completely added on expense, whereas a railroad at least, well, you get some trade, you get commerce going, you know, get all kinds of economic progress within a year or two probably.
Here we get in a funny way through thinking about this as a problem of taxation, what we get to is the heart of the new alliance, the reconstructed alliance between slaveholding and non-slaveholding whites. That alliance had been held in place and cemented by slavery until and through parts of the Civil War. It had come undone at the end of the Civil War as non-slaveholding white Southerners realized, to some degree at least, that they were being asked to fight a war on behalf of slavery and that they were just dying in it to no good of their own. What happens after the Civil War is there's a moment at which it's possible for the Republicans to recruit some number of non-slaveholding white Southerners and perhaps some former slaveholders into their ranks. Republican tax policy in the 1870s goes some way toward undoing that potential for an interracial alliance in the Republican Party. Because if you think about it, people who are still big landowners, former slaveholders who are now sort of landlords, have a great interest in not educating black Southerners. To them, educated black Southerners are people who will not be happy to be agricultural laborers, especially low-paid agricultural laborers. At the very least, they're going to want land of their own. And if they don't want that, they're going to want to move to town. They're going to want to move north. They're going to want to establish themselves as independent, educated people in some other context. They're not going to want to be laborers. The labor supply is going to shrink. The cost of labor is going to go up. And more of those landlords are going to lose their land. Okay. But from the perspective of people who don't own a lot of land, people who are not going to be big employers of ill-educated black labor if they can keep them, in ignorance, for those people, Republican tax policy is also a problem because even if they don't have a deep interest, deep and abiding interest in keeping freed people from becoming literate, from becoming educated, from advancing economically and professionally, they do have an interest in not paying taxes for many of these purposes Republican governments have in mind. Though they are comparatively poor in the old scheme of things, in the pre-war scheme of things, they're much richer than former slaves, most of them. There are some white Southerners who are as poor slaves but as former slaves, but there are not so many. Most white Southerners are better off than that even after the Civil War. And to them, it does look like a kind of redistribution to former slaves. Whether or not that's actually the case bears scrutinizing. It's not clear, in fact, that people who had not been slaveholders are contributing in some great degree to the education or other well-being of former slaves. Nonetheless, that case is possible to make because even people who hadn't been slaveholders look at former slaves taking up positions of power, assuming kinds of social prerogatives they'd never had before, and it rubs them the wrong way too. Because one of the things that slavery had cemented for them was a sense of shared white privilege, and that's been eroded.
Once we get to that election, that razor-thin controversial election of 1876, the one that in effect guarantees that one way or the other, whoever's elected, those Union armies will leave the South, how does that affect what happens to Reconstruction politics?
Well, the election of 1876 is both cause and effect of an unraveling of Reconstruction. It's the effect of an unraveling in the sense that the election can only be close because conservatives who sometimes go by conservative and sometimes go by Democrat have successfully regained power everywhere in the South where there isn't a black majority, pretty much. That is, they've been able by force or by fraud or by some combination to retake power in the state governments and to effectively call the count, to be able to say, no, we won this election. At this level, at the county level, at the precinct level, we won this election and we stuffed the ballot box if we didn't. So the only reason the election of 1876 can be close is because the Democrats have already won so many southern states this way in the 1870s. The way in which the election of 1876 is a cause of the end of Reconstruction is that, as you said, yeah, as a consequence of the Republicans being in such a poor position at the end of the initial count in November, they are faced either with the prospect of the Democrat being elected president, in which case definitely federal troops will be withdrawn from the remaining southern capitals, or the Republican will be elected, but in the way that it actually occurs, the Republican is elected by making a series of deals with the Democrats to get the electoral votes from the remaining disputed states, but in exchange for that, removing the remaining federal troops from southern courthouses and state houses, and creating a kind of a detente in which both sides agree they will not pursue election fraud cases against one another after the fact. And all of this, this very complicated bargain that leads to the Compromise of 1877, as it's called, this very complicated series of electoral bargains is greased and maybe in fact primarily has to do with enormous federal subsidies for railroads, for levies, for this, for that, to kind of grease the way and persuade recalcitrant congressmen to get on board and do the right thing and make this bargain happen. The effect for the remaining Southern Republicans is intensely demoralizing, completely dispiriting. You know, many in South Carolina, for example, the Republicans who believed that they should have won the election of 1876 at the state level and maybe even had won the election of 1876 at the state level, the Republican Party was still very well mobilized, very effective political enterprise in South Carolina. They really feel that they've been abandoned by the federal government. They've essentially kept up a dual government throughout the winter and spring of 1877 on the hope that somehow the Congress would finally recognize them, refuse to seat their Democratic opponents in Congress, refuse to recognize the Democratic claimant to the governorship, Wade Hampton, but instead would recognize them. And then finally, when the troops are withdrawn, the Republicans just the leading Republicans just leave town.
We call this period Reconstruction, but presumably at the time they didn't feel they were in Reconstruction. It's a later term being applied.
Well, they did actually call this period Reconstruction. The moment that I'm talking about here goes by another name, and the name that belongs to the victors of it belongs to the conservatives and the white supremacists, and that is Redemption. To our ears, it's become a fairly neutral term, although some historians have been fighting against the use of it. Friends of mine who were children of preachers say it's blasphemy because a political group having overthrown a political order is claiming for themselves the title of Redeemer, which at this moment in 19th century America in a highly Christianized political culture, that's a pretty profound thing to say about oneself, that you have redeemed a region from something.
It's a commercial term too, though. You redeem your green stamps.
That's true.
Sort of thing. And in a sense, they might have been figuring that they were finally collecting on what was owed them in some more commercial sense. Well, by the time we get to 1880, 1884, 1888, what is the South starting to look like? We hear about the solid South in political terms and voting patterns.
Well, what's really striking is how long it takes to establish that solid South. It was once thought, maybe 50 years ago, that after Reconstruction, Democrats consolidated power and we had a solid South that lasted, you know, really till the civil rights movement.
Yes.
In fact, it takes Democratic white supremacy until the end of the century to accomplish the full and final overthrow of Reconstruction. And that's for at least two reasons. One reason is those pesky Reconstruction amendments. You know, say what you will about the failure of Congress to enforce them, the failure of the Supreme Court to honor their substance. They exist. The 15th Amendment in particular, very, very troublesome. the right of suffrage shall not be abridged on the basis of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. You have no idea how much this bothers Democratic white supremacists in the late 19th century South. They would like nothing better than to repeal the 15th Amendment and be able to say, as would be very convenient, black men can't vote. But they can't do it. It's in the Constitution. So they have to find an absurd array of proxies for race, many of which capture many white men as well. And so every time you come up with a proxy for race, education, ability to pay a tax, literacy, property ownership, you capture a huge number of white men who also don't meet that standard and who are also therefore disqualified from voting. And those white voters are not dumb. They see what's happening and they're going to vote against people who are supporting such legislation. So it's a very dicey proposition trying to formally, fully disenfranchise black men. So there's that problem. The second problem, and one that follows almost directly from it, is that black men continue to be able to vote in some places in the South. They continue to have at least vestigial alliances with white Republicans who in some places are considerable, Western North Carolina as I mentioned before. And in those places, under some circumstances, especially when the Democrats fracture over one thing or another, Republicans, including black Republicans, are able to get back into office. So in Virginia – in 1879, a dissident third party movement among white Democrats ends up creating an interracial coalition that takes power again and governs Virginia till 1883 when it's overthrown in what looks very much like the overthrow of Reconstruction. So you think that's it. Okay, then the Democrats are going to figure out how to really do it. It's not going to happen again. Lo and behold, late 1880s, Farmers Alliance turns into the People's Party, into populism as we know it. And by the early 1890s, you've got a populist movement that's making alliance with the remaining Republican Party in the South. And in North Carolina in 1894, they sweep the state legislature. They take power in North Carolina again for 4 years till 1898 when they're overthrown by a Democratic white supremacy movement that calls itself the Red Shirts, in fact. And only after that, only after the overthrow of Reconstruction, of this sort of second wave of Reconstruction in North Carolina in 1898, is North Carolina able to safely call a constitutional convention in which they rewrite the state's law sufficiently to disfranchise most black men until the 1960s.
Our guest has been Steve Kantrowitz. Thanks for deconstructing the Reconstruction.
It's been great. My pleasure.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.